good morning from San Francisco on the 29th of November, 2011. My name is Brian Madden. Joining me in the studio, San Francisco, always, Brother Jack.
Good morning.
And our guest today, Mr. Chetan Venkatesh, CTO and founder of Atlantis Computing, and three-time Bri Forum speaker, I believe, and contributor to BrianMadden.com. So, Chetan, thank you for joining.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Jack. This is a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
And always, of course, Gabe is coming to us from Omaha.
You bet. How you doing, Chetan?
I'm doing awesome. This, you know, it's just, I'm sitting here in your studio marveling at this amazing piece of technology and marveling at the fact
all that we pulled off.
99% of this stuff is on the cloud. I mean, wow, what an idea. And we'll talk about that. I mean,
we talk now about that. You know, this is so Chetan walks in and is like, so what is this thing exactly? And I said, yeah, it just doesn't matter. Put on the headphones, talking to here, and you're allowed to say fuck if you want.
Awesome.
And that's essentially, you know, that's how it is. But yeah, this whole thing we were talking is cloud based. I know that we've mentioned that before, but we actually use Amazon's. They've got an offering called CloudFront, so it's Amazon Media Encoder in the cloud. It's Amazon Edge Network, their global, you know, geolocated DNS hosting, all of this kind of stuff. And this entire show, I'm not kidding, costs, I think our bill to Amazon is like $4 an hour.
Wow.
Because we turn on the whole stack a half hour before the show. We, you know, bill to our credit card, and as soon as the show is over, we cut down the stack, you know, terminate the whole thing, and the clock stops ticking.
That's amazing.
So it's
we just about put the show together on a college credit card, you know, like a $500 credit card. We could, you know, we've done a lot with very little to make this show happen.
And in many ways, you know, everybody tends to think YouTube is this great democratization of media, but to me, in many ways, this is taking it, you know, several levels, several notches above that. I mean, go back 10 years. What did it cost to reach out to, you know, say 500,000 people? Over a show like this, probably costed, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and at $4 for an hour, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if we have 500,000 visitors, it'll probably go up to a little bit higher, but
yeah, well,
maybe $10. But that's, I mean, yeah, it's crazy. And we do almost, I think, have 500,000 listeners, plus or minus a few, half a million or so.
100,000. Yeah.
So Chetan, I mean, you know, as I was telling you earlier, we began this show based on the fact that Gabe and I were always talking to each other on the phone for like an hour. And we're like, you know, man, we should just record this because people would like to hear what we say, I think. And, you know,
the best part is, you know, we can't hear them talking back and saying, oh, those guys don't know anything. Although we do have the chat room.
Yeah. But you know, Chetan, you and I mean, so first of all, you drove up here from Mountain View, I think.
Yeah, well, Belmont, San Mateo.
Okay, thank you for coming so early. It's really goddamn early to get up and drive up here. But, you know, you and I get together, I don't know, every few months, and, you know, we have dinner, whiskey, and cigarettes, and just kind of chat about the industry. So,
right.
You know, we haven't done that in a while, so let's catch up. So how you doing?
It's been great, Brian. It's probably been, you know, an intense year for the industry as a whole. There's just so much going on. Everybody has gotten happy and then resigned and cynical about WDI, and then sort of now you're starting to see some elements of hope and, anticipation that things are changing, you know, things are maturing. And it's finally going to be the decade of VDI or whatever. You know, every year is called the year of VDI, and that's an old joke already. But I think we're sort of starting to see some light come through the clouds now, finally. There's, I think, a strong momentum in adoption now, finally, around VDI. I, for one, am seeing, you know, fairly large VDI installations, 5,000 to 15,000, 20,000 users. Happen. And, you know, I predicted, you know, 3 years back, what was it, 75% of all Windows desktops will be consumed through, you know, some sort of a VDI sort of a model. You know, we're not there yet, but it certainly is inching towards that at a glacial pace, and it'll happen. And in that process, just like a glacier, you know, carves an entire geology around it, I think VDI will carve a completely new ecosystem around this model of IT. And, you know, certainly all that you've done with discussing consumerization of IT, I think in many ways is evidence to that happening already. There is just a complete disconnect between how enterprises do Windows and service delivery of desktops versus how users think their IT needs to come to them. And that disconnect is just driving users to be more innovative, more creative, and because they've got access to such new services, you know, in such an easy way, a credit card away, literally, they're reaching out to them. And all of that is a part of this VDI momentum. It's not isolated. This whole movement away from the physical into a data center, into the cloud somewhere.
So what do you think is the catalyst for that now? You know, if it is an old joke now that, you know, next year, you know, quote unquote, will be the year of VDI, but now you're saying it's actually starting to happen. Is it that is the technology better? Has the price come down? Have people reset their expectations to be lower to where they can now actually see VDI be successful?
A combination of all of the above. I certainly think that there was a tremendous amount of gap in the technology itself. Each vendor was a part of that ecosystem in many ways had not figured out where they fit and how they interlock with the others. I mean, go back 3 years and 5 years. Atlantis, for one, was everything to everyone. And there were many like us, right? And what's happened over the last 3 years has been a strong crystallization of what each vendor, what each part of the ecosystem does very well, and it interlocks with what is underneath it and what is about it in a much better way. And that has, I think, in many ways eliminated a lot of the technology risk that came with trying to adopt VDI. I've got customers who probably attempted VDI 5 years back, and 80% of the effort that they put into doing this was their own. Vendors contributed 20%. I think it's flipped around now, where you can pretty much buy 80% of the stack today, and 20% is, you know, your own effort in terms of customizing that and making it work for your organization. The other thing I think is I tend to talk about VDI in an enterprise context. I do not talk about it in so much an SMB or a consumer context, because to me, those are overlays that are happening around VDI. But to me, the enterprise desktop and that going into the cloud is really the essence of VDI.
Do you think that... You know, I think Atlantis Computing was probably early on, for me, one of the companies that really started embodying this whole layering concept. Mm-hmm. And now we have other companies doing it. I mean, we've got, Virtual Computer. We've got Mocha 5. Ron Oglesby's in our chat room. I assume that's you, Ron. Hey. And so there's a lot of people doing layering.
Yep.
Now, but I mean, is you guys are doing layering. I mean, is this idea that we're going to have sort of a layered, dynamically created desktop? Is that the model of Windows and VDI, or is it more about just moving the existing machines they have into a data center and delivering Windows in a one-to-one way?
So I think that the layerization, the decomponentization of Windows from a technical perspective has been done, and there are some great technologies out there. Unidesk, Vonova, certainly come to mind. And at a technical level, they've, I think, figured out and covered the entire surface of the problem area. But from a Windows management, deployment, delivery standpoint, the organizations that buy these services are not mature enough to rethink their approaches. There are customers who are. There are companies that are. And they tend to go to this non-persistent, stateless model straight away. They embrace that opportunity to change, you know, what they see as 15 years of problems. Whereas others have invested in those problems at such a fundamental level that it's very hard to throw the, you know, baby out with the bathwater in many ways. That's how they see the problem. And so they tend to take these baby steps. And baby step number one is, let me just take the physical estate the way it is, you know, stick it in the data center exactly the way it is, and then iterate over that in small increments to see how I can get to statelessness. And that's really the bulk of, you know, people out there attempting VDI. And those are the people that I think in many ways have been cynical about it, because taking that approach is actually extremely complex. But if you take the decomponentization, the layering approach, it's actually much simpler, although there's a much bigger learning curve and, you know, intellectual effort involved in that is far higher. But if you attempted that and you did it, you actually get there much faster. So, you know, it's both of these aspects. There are two sides of this VDI coin in many ways.
It's like, I don't know what the analogy is here. It's like a surface tension thing. You've got higher surface tension to go to the sort of layered, dynamically constructed approach. But once you break through, you can sort of slingshot ahead.
Exactly.
of like actually change the way that you deliver Windows.
You know, think about what you've done over here with the cloud, and I'll try to make this analogy. It's going to be fairly nebulous, so bear with me. But you know, let's go back 10 years, and a recording studio like this was, I don't know, $1 million investment. And the ability to broadcast this to even 100 users, 1,000 users, you know, was so high. In fact, it didn't, you know, the minimum, I guess, viable population for this to make sense was, I don't know, maybe 100,000 people listening to this show. If you had anything less than that, it wasn't possible. But you've had all these components, sort of break apart. The studio has become virtual. All the pieces have sort of flowed in and out. And what makes sense to be in the cloud has flowed into that. And as a result now, you know, once you're willing to put all these pieces together and rethink this entire thing, you can actually make your minimum viable population as low as 100 and get away with it for $4 an hour. Many ways, this decomponentization and layerization works exactly the same way. You've got to be willing to make that investment. But the minute you do that, it dramatically alters the entire cost picture, the entire outreach, and the way you can actually, you know, do Windows and desktops.
So I've always been skeptical that the layering actually works, because I felt like the core technology to isolate applications over here and user settings over here and operating system stuff there, that was easy enough. But what happens when you get into a scenario where the user installs an application and then the admin wants to patch a layer below it, but that lower layer is not compatible with that application? Doesn't that throw up some kind of exception? Then you have to disable some application or that doesn't work right. And don't you have enough of those exceptions that it just breaks the whole thing and layering just kind of doesn't work for people?
Well, it's not a blanket, approach for sure. You've got to treat it like a pyramid. I think there's a big population of users, you know, and if you sort of draw it out as a pyramid, that it works for. And then there is some population at the top it doesn't work for. And, you know, if anything, there is a lot of improvement in UIA. UIA is now compared to where it was even 24 months ago.
UIA being user-installed applications.
Yeah, exactly, user-installed apps. It's come a very long way. And there's also a commoditization happening over there. I mean, Absence is now giving that away as a part of their product portfolio, right? So, it might not cover 100% of the surface, but it covers enough of the surface for it to be a very viable strategy for the vast majority of your users, you know, not necessarily for everyone. And it doesn't have to be.
And nobody's doing it quite the same way.
I'm sorry?
Nobody's doing it quite the same way either. The UIA, it's kind of like AppVert. Like, everybody has a slightly different method of doing it. Yeah. And so, like you mentioned, how Absence is giving it away, but Absence's solution maybe isn't as robust as, you know, say Unidesk's or Winova's or Mocha 5's.
Sure, you know, this the beauty of my job is I get to talk about all these things just by reading about them, so I won't get into which one's better and which one's not. But
No, I'm not saying that at all.
I understand. But at a broader level, every vendor needs to differentiate, and so everybody tells the same thing a little different way, but they're fundamentally, you know, similar approaches. But yeah, everybody does them differently. Sure.
And so you say you're starting to see some decent VDI deployments, you know, 5 to 15,000. Are these people doing layering for some portion of those users, or are they doing layering for all their VDI users, but they've only brought over the use cases that could be layered?
Yeah, so what typically tends to happen is layering is a sort of a second version of their VDI. So it's VDI 2.0 for them. And that's where they've basically done the VDI 1.0, in many ways amortized the pain of getting that up and running, and now are looking for value and efficiencies around the life cycle of the desktop. In VDI 1.0, a lot of the times it's security, it's, you know, capital investment, it's refresh, those sorts of very capital decisions that drive it. And once that is done, efficiencies in life cycle and operations are the next set of, you know, fruits that they want to capture. And so a lot of customers, I think, tend to attack the layerization as the second stage once they have a fundamental understanding of what it means to put this Windows desktop in the data center. So I would say I think it's more like 80-20. 80% of the customers are doing VDI 1.0, just forklifting this thing onto the data center, and then 20% of them are doing VDI 2.0, which is now looking to, you know, re-engineer the desktop and capture those efficiencies.
So one of the things I'm curious from everyone when I hear that, you know, they start to see sort of VDI out in the wild. What are you seeing in terms of both platforms and, you know, just based on your knowledge, does it seem like a lot of people are on vSphere, people using, you know, Hyper-V or Zen Server? And then what about, are they Vue customers? Are they Zen Desktop? Are they Vue Workspace? Are they what?
So I think we used to see a lot of Zen Desktop out there, and now we're starting to see a lot more Vue. customers out there. So it's you know, it's started balancing out. And I would say, from my perspective, it's almost 50-50 at this point.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's and the new release of Vue, you know, I think has got some great features as well that has helped that. From a hypervisor perspective, ESX, vSphere have been, you know, the dominant platforms. In the U.S., we still tend to see a lot of them, you know, just running on vSphere in their data centers because that's what they've, you know, instituted. But in Europe, we're starting to see a lot of Hyper-V. For whatever reason, you know, there's a lot more appetite for Hyper-V-based deployments over there. Starting to see that. Zen Server is there. The licensing just makes so much sense that a lot of customers, you know, opt for that. And, you know, so I'd say Hyper-V and Zen Server sort of on par. And but ESX is still by far the most dominant platform for the hypervisor.
For these people who are doing VDI 2.0, mm-hmm. as you're saying, are these people who've started VDI, I don't know, 5 years ago, and now they're sort of re-engineering their VDI environment? Or do you see people jumping straight to this sort of rethought desktop, you know, built on layers, where they're doing that as their first jump into VDI?
So it's usually this is a long tail of Windows applications within that organization that dictates whether they do 2.0 or 1.0. The more apps you have virtualized or available in a package format to deploy, you know, the easier it is to go to that 2.0 model. So customers with a limited inventory of apps and smaller lines of businesses typically embrace 2.0 straight away. They don't want to go through the 1.0 process. But customers who have a very large inventory of applications, who have a multi-year effort just virtualizing them and packaging them up, they're the ones that do the 1.0 and the 2.0. So that, to me, sort of seems to be the way, you know, this particular problem gets attacked. It's the inventory of applications and how, you know, how do they package that up.
So if anyone has any questions or wants to join this conversation, feel free to post that into the chat. It's funny, Dan Brinkman past Bri Forum speaker and one of the members of the Denver Virtual Desktop Drinking Association, kind of writes all this, you know, apps and strata is not even released yet. And here we're saying, oh, user installed apps. Oh, this is free now, actually. But, you know, it's
free if you already have AppSense.
I guess that's true, too. So a lot for us, it's, you know, I wonder if there's people, I mean, because layering doesn't necessarily mean user installed apps, or I guess. Or does it? I mean, I guess
it should.
It should.
That's my opinion. I think that once the enabling technology is there, there is no reason not to use it. Of course, there are enterprises that will always have a philosophical, you know, concern about that, and that's a matter of time. But UI, I think, is a very important aspect of it. And if the technology can support it in a way that alleviates these security concerns and, you know, management concerns, then, you know, by all means, go for it. Use it. Carpet bomb it, you know.
In order for the technology to support it from a sort of security standpoint, is that something that sort of layering fixes, or is that done by something else, some kind of security software, policy software I've got running in my desktops?
I think that's the big evolutionary piece that's now happening within UIA, which is people have realized it's not just a filter driver that redirects all this crap and puts it in some sort of a user layer. It's what's the policy engine that allows, you know, things to come through, things not to come through, that can, you know, enable, disable, et cetera. And that's the next piece that's sort of getting layered over there. I don't know enough about each vendor's prop to tell you who has it and who doesn't, but that certainly seems to be now sort of where most of these guys are innovating, putting that policy and layer, you know, and rules around, you know, how these layers are created, consumed, et cetera, and, you know, decommissioned, all of that stuff.
So I want to ask you about Atlantis Computing.
Yeah.
But first, let's take a quick sort of 30-second commercial break because, hey, we have a sponsor again this week. So today's episode of Brian and Gabe Live is sponsored by Citrix Go to Manage. Citrix believes that while desktop virtualization is loaded with benefits, it's not going to give you a free pass on desktop management. In fact, if you didn't have a need for remote management and desktop support before, you definitely do now in a virtual desktop environment. So this is where Citrix Online can help. They have a cloud-based IT services tool called Citrix GoToManage. It combines best-in-class remote support with network monitoring and alerting capabilities, giving IT professionals like you total control of your IT world. With Citrix GoToManage, you can instantly deliver live support to customers or access unattended computers and servers. You can monitor the performance of desktops, servers, and networks. You can stay on top of issues with proactive alerts. And now there's GoToManage Mobile, which provides support right from your iPad. So if you want to try Citrix GoToManage for yourself, just go to GoToManage.com, click on the free trial button, and enter the promo code Madden45. And the Madden45 promo code, it's a special code for Brian and Gabe live listeners, which makes your trial last 45 days instead of whatever the lower standard is. So desktop management, tech support, and monitoring has never been so easy. That's Citrix Online's GoToManage. Thank you so much, Citrix, for your support. Back to you, Chetan. So I want to talk a little bit about Atlantis Computing specifically. And obviously, you know, this is I've always enjoyed talking to you, but since you are the founder of Atlantis, let's just kind of get an update, because I think I first wrote about Atlantis in 2009 or something like that. And I remember at the time, you know, so I wrote about Atlantis back in the day. You know, we've interviewed, you know, Jim Moyle is an Atlantis employee, also another Briform speaker. We've gotten updates from him, but just kind of give us, you know, 30 seconds on Atlantis and then update us on sort of where you guys are now.
Sure. It's been, you know, I started the company in 07. So, you know, it's been 4 years. It's been a great ride. We've, in many ways, helped, you know, build this ecosystem. We're an important part of it. And as a founder, it's very satisfying to now see crystallization of so many of these things that we envisioned 4 years back happening. From a company perspective, we've actually been more or less, you know, not, you know, out of the startup mode into more of a real business. We've added tons of new customers in the last 12 to 18 months, you know, 60-odd new customers, a lot of them being repeat customers. So from a business perspective, you know, the business is growing as, you know, VDI sort of this trickles upward. We've been focused a lot on the storage side of the equation, even though initially we started off, you know, dealing with the decomponentization and the layers, you know, that could be, you know, used to manage Windows better. But fundamentally, what we had was a piece of technology that at a storage level was content-aware. This is a piece of software that speaks NTFS and speaks storage and virtualization. And so we decided that really the best place for us was to add value to the hypervisors by bringing content awareness to it. And so we built this virtual machine, Ilio, that basically optimizes VDI I/O and eliminates all the challenges that come with storage in a VDI deployment. And that has worked really well for us. You know, we've built a very strong business around that with, you know, 70-odd partners and some of the largest deployments globally. I know this one will probably get some eyes rolling because we always talk about it, but JP Morgan Chase, you know, I think 45,000 desktops today in production. And that's probably the biggest one from a layered perspective. This is actual deployment of layering, managing, using layers, et cetera, and 45,000 global users on that platform. So that's been an enormous success for us. But outside of that, mainstream, I would say, success with VMware, with CB Richard Ellis in Europe. They've you know, standardized on us, got some very large federal customers in defense, et cetera. And we've also moved towards some new areas of innovation. So we're actually going to announce, and I'm sort of going to preempt the marketing guys by announcing it because I, you know, this is the show to do it at.
Hey.
We're actually announcing something that we call Storageless VDI in a week. And what Storageless VDI does is it actually eliminates the bulk of storage that is required to power VDI for running the operating system and the application working set. And it does that by using a piece of RAM, memory, ultra-fast memory, right, as the storage layer for running the operating system and the application. And just the user data gets shunted away to some sort of persistent storage. And so if you look at VDI, the vast majority of storage that's being built into VDI is just there to run the operating system and run the applications. It's not really there to store data. It's there to just store the VMDK and power the IOPS that are required to run Windows. And so we're actually delivering that off just RAM. And we've tightly integrated this with Cisco. And so the Cisco UCS platform is what we're making this offering on. They've got some amazing technology that lets you do high memory density blades. And so we've got a blade, the B230, for example, with 512 gigs of RAM that you put an Ilio on, and you support 160 desktops. There's a 500,000 IOPS within each blade. And so needless to say, IOPS is no longer your problem.
I guess not. Is money my problem?
No, you'd be surprised, and it's a great question. The actual cost per desktop is about $200. It's actually cheaper than any form of conventional storage that you throw at this thing. So it's a great piece of innovation because it addresses the cost angle, it addresses, you know, the infrastructure angle, and, you know, it's trying to solve the problem the right way. And we've got about 3 customer deployments for this already. So
on UCS.
On UCS, yeah.
Does your 3 customers using UCS encompass all customers who are using UCS?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a small population. But if I look at the UCS, I think it's the ultimate VDI machine. Lots of memory and lots of CPU. And the ability to have the back channel just move I/O very quickly between blades. So it is, in many ways, VDI is the killer app for this machine.
So I want to ask you more about that, but Ron's asking in the chat. He says that Elio I/O stuff rocks. Are you still doing top of the rack appliances and VM appliances?
That's a great question, Ron, and shout out to you. Thanks for that question. So we actually are just a VM appliance. We're nothing but a virtual machine. And by the way, we also have support for now Zen Server and Hyper-V. We are on all 3 hypervisors today. So that's actually another piece that I want to get out there. But it's a VM appliance, and as a result, it can actually be deployed on top of a hypervisor, either top of rack or underneath. All that changes is the kind of storage adapter that you put to it and the number of VMs that you would house on each machine. If you're top of rack, it's great for a conventional persistent desktop model. You simply stick us top of rack, plug us between your storage and the VDI rack, and simply migrate, vMotion your users from their existing VDI estate or from, you know, P2V them from physical to virtual, and you're off and running. It'll automatically get optimized and it'll run off this thing. But if you truly want to leverage statelessness and all the lovely layering stuff, you know, that's out there from Unidesk and all these guys, you can actually deploy us on each server. And what happens when you do that is essentially you can leverage local storage on each host for some of those layers. It sort of tiers the storage automatically for you. But more importantly, all the I/O stays within the host and will go as fast as the CPUs will let you. So you essentially get 10 gig or more, you know, within that host without actually needing to invest in that 10 gig.
Is that all in memory then, or do you need to have like a Fusion I/O and SSD or something like that?
It can actually leverage anything. So it can leverage pure memory, as in the case of UCS and storageless VDI.
The pure memory is what will be. But do you need UCS for pure memory, or can I, if I have just regular rack mount servers, can I put an Elio VM on each host and then have it, that VM have memory that's used as my storage?
Well, we've got some integration points with UCS today that leverage the high memory density. So once those sorts of integration points are available on other, you know, conventional commodity servers, yes. But today, the memory solution is fairly UCS specific. But you can stick an SSD in there. You can stick in Fusion I/O in there. Hell, you can even stick in a bunch of SAS drives and RAID them together and use that as your local storage environment. And this is going to optimize all the I/O to that.
Wouldn't have to fill this room with SAS drives to get a 500,000 IOPS.
Well, here's what we've got. A certified configuration with 4 15K SAS drives that gives you 68,000 IOPS on an Elio. So, you know, if you want 68,000 IOPS, which is more than plenty for the 60, 70 desktops that you'll run
on. And I guess because Elio itself is reducing the amount of IOPS you need per desktop anyway, because you're getting sort of that, does it still use that flock thing, that kind of file block level?
So what's happened is that flock stuff went from being more about a management interface to being an underlying IO and NTFS processing technology. So what we're doing is we're sitting in line, fronting and creating fake virtual machines that the hypervisor boots and runs. And as that I/O goes back and forth, we're actually using this characterization that is the flock to, I got to be really careful how I say that, we're using this flock technology to basically characterize, figure out what that I/O is. Is that a paging request? Is that a change to, you know, some specific user file? Or, you know, is that a registry edit? And all of those are treated differently by the Elio appliance. So it basically gets characterized. We figure out what it is, what the request is, write, read, and what particular NTFS level object. And then second level, deduplicate that. Remove it off the wire. And that's a pretty neat trick because we don't actually commit the data anywhere before we remove it off the wire. It's actually just picking it off.
So it's not like a batch process. It's data deduplication. It's never duplicated in the first place.
Exactly. It's complete single instancing of the write side and the read side as a result of that. And then it comes into a special, you know, intelligent caching mechanism, which is very NTFS specific. And so different objects get cached in different ways and serviced different ways. And ultimately, it gets written to disk in a very efficient way.
So how do you know how to do all this?
Well,
like, this is I mean, this is some hardcore stuff.
It is. It is some like crazy stuff.
Some dude sitting here, like, where'd you learn this stuff?
Well, you know, I'd love to take full credit for it, and I will. But, you know, I honestly, that would be just complete embellishment. We lucked out. We got some really great engineers who had worked in conventional storage systems and were frustrated with the way these storage technologies were trying to fulfill VDI. So we lucked out in that we got some really hardcore guys come aboard with understanding of file systems and layouts, NTFS, et cetera. And so, you know, ultimately, it was just a combination of the right talent with the right ideas and some kick-ass engineering, you know, management that sort of built this product for us.
So Atlantis, I remember when we were talking to you, you know, 2.5 years ago or whatever, yeah. It was really about that whole layering and like Elia was about management.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, I guess, part of that became in the way you did the management, you could really handle super fast I/O, and especially across a lot of sort of similar type machines. And I know that it seems like Atlantis went to focus on the server space, just accelerating, you know, virtual server storage for virtual servers too.
Right.
So how do you feel like Atlantis now is the focus to accelerate storage that works for servers and desktops, or is there a desktop management play still in here? Or is that even a bullshit question to say, hey, what are you, man, desktop management or storage?
We still have the desktop management stuff, and it's in deployment. We have several customers who use it, but it's not the front and center of our business. We're a storage optimization company, and you know, we support all management layering products. And personally, you know, my own interest is in the plumbing and how to make shit go faster. That's really what I care about, you know, and those I think are very interesting, compelling innovations to bring to market. The layering stuff is important, and I think there's a lot of innovation in different places. You know, in some ways, I wouldn't call it better, but probably attacks the surface much, you know, in a much cleaner way. So our layering makes a lot of sense when you're a certain style of deployment and you're willing to think the Elio way. But if you're more of a conventional shop and you know the product, you know, there are more generic options available. That's how I'd put it. So we're really storage optimization. We're really about changing the form and function of the storage. We're about accelerating desktops. We're about accelerating servers. We're about shrinking the storage footprint. And where it makes sense, we have a layering and a management piece that can help you provision better, clone faster, and manage those desktops in a more efficient way.
So it seems if you look at the world of storage as it applies to desktops and VDI, there's sort of two, I don't know what I want to call them, waves coming together, right? One wave, I could say, is companies like Atlantis, like Unidesk, Wenova, Mocha, like all the layering type, management type companies, and they're working on, you know, single instance, whether it's file, block, combination, whatever. But then there's also this, the sort of more traditional storage companies. I mean, I look at like Extreme.io, look at Nutanix to some extent, a lot of these startups who are looking purely at the sort of storage appliance level. Maybe Atlantis kind of rides both of those, but these are coming together. Do you see consolidation? Like, is this something where the, you know, the management-oriented companies are all bought by bigger storage companies, or these smaller kind of, you know, single instance block level companies are bought by bigger companies, and in 2 or 3 years, is all this just you buy storage from HP or Dell or EMC or whatever, and you just get all this functionality anyway, or do you think this stays as its own like niche kind of add-on?
Yeah, I think there's gonna be consolidation. It just has to happen. So it probably plays out in a much bigger time frame. It doesn't play out as simply as, you know, X will buy Y. But one thing for sure, I think everybody's starting to appreciate that decomponentization is a very important part of layer management. And who the layer management vendors are is fairly nebulous. Is it Microsoft with their way of approaching it, or is it Citrix, for example, with the RingCube acquisition, right? So there's definitely going to be consolidation. And conventional storage companies are very, very challenged right now to find a strategy and a product and a technology approach to solve this problem, and they will buy where they can. There's all sorts of interesting, you know, discussions right now of even non-conventional, you know, not necessarily storage or VDI companies trying to enter the space. There are companies that, you know, there are companies that, for example, are in the robo market and are thinking about how do you deliver VDI to the, you know, remote office in some non-conventional ways rather than just accelerating, you know, the network ICA or RDP, but you know, how do you actually accelerate, you know, the storage function itself? So there's all these interesting, you know, mechanics that are in movement right now.
And I guess, you know, when you wrote a few years ago that you thought whatever it was, you know, 2/3, 3/4 of future instances of Windows will be delivered in some kind of VDI-like model.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought that was hogwash. Most of it would be local. I have since turned 180 degrees, and now I'm 100% on board with you. We can talk about that in a minute.
Sure.
But then Tim Mangan kind of called us out and said, nah, Brian and Chetan are both wrong. It's really about data
yeah.
and where the data is. And I guess data and storage are almost the same thing. We talk about storage. It also enables, you know, where the Windows runs and that kind of stuff. But if you look at the data, there is an angle there also, right? Like, because if you look at it, like, do I really need my desktop or do I just need my Dropbox contents? And so maybe that's what you talk about, these other angles. So I guess a company like, maybe it's like a Dropbox or a cloud right. provider, or, you know, look at like the network acceleration vendors, or look at these, that they may take this approach and flip it completely, where they're looking at solving the same problem that VDI solves, but not with centralized copies of Microsoft Windows, but rather making the data so you have whatever you need wherever you are. And I guess that's kind of where you're going with this when you talk about how these different vendors could come together.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that in some ways it's a redundant point of view. Data was the first to move to the cloud in the first place. Before all this shit went to the cloud, data was there already. I mean, you started using Dropbox before, and it was a much easier, you know, way to get, you know, to use and consume that service than it is to, you know, put Windows in a data center. So, you know, data, just where it's stored is immaterial. You know, the whole conversation of whether it's local or whether it's in the cloud is a stupid conversation, because it doesn't matter as long as you can get access to that.
So I'm like writing that article, fuck the SAN, and your article is fuck the conversation about fuck the SAN.
Exactly. So in many ways, it's just that. So with data there in the cloud or wherever you need it to be, the heart of the question is, where do you run Windows if it is not strategic, if it's a tactical tool for just running applications? What's the most efficient way? And we've covered this before, right? And you know, the answer is it's on an EC2 like cloud, where you get these large economies of scale. And you can drive more users per server, per rack, and drop that cost down and make that minimum viable population, right? As small as possible. So it has to lead that way, because that's what makes fundamentally cost sense and efficiency sense.
So based on that, people who aren't doing sort of VDI today, have the reasons for going to VDI, or has the barrier to VDI significantly changed? You know, you said that more people are doing it, but I mean, if I've got a bunch of traditional desktops today, do I wait another couple of years and wait for all this? You know, now you've got with UCS only in memory based, local server kind of using to serve IO out of there. But if I wait another 6 months or a year, I can have that on all platforms. And if I wait another year, I mean,
yeah.
Do I want to wait a couple of years and do it, you know, once we fix the storage problem, or do I want to wade into this myself right now?
So I'll take a little bit of a different angle on this one, Brian. So I think that what VDI is tied into a much bigger macro set of trends. It's not tied into a technical reason to do it. It's tied into some very economic reasons. The number one being that there is a drive towards efficiency in every enterprise in America. Everyone wants to get as efficient as possible. And a part of that is they're restructuring the businesses to basically outsource as much as possible. So, you know, almost every customer I talk to has that as, you know, a very hot, you know, issue that might be latent in the organization, but it's certainly driving things. So when what they're trying to do is build a desktop fabric, a compute fabric that can service their conventional business as well as that, you know, new model of doing business with outsourced providers, et cetera. It's a very fluid environment. And they look at VDI as fundamentally being that fabric that can be extended, you know, out into the outsourced and back into the insourced and within the corporation, et cetera. So that tends to drive a lot of this conversation. It's not just that the technology pieces are there. And so in many ways, the amount of energy that's underneath the VDI movement is much higher than we appreciate as technical folks, because we tend to look at checkboxes and see if this stupid thing works with that stupid thing and say it does and it should happen now. But underneath it are just much bigger macroeconomic forces at work. And fundamentally, the world economically is changing. You know, it's an amazing time to be alive and watch all this, you know, if you can get past the drama. But that reshaping is very fundamentally tied to how this compute fabric is delivered to people who are part of an organization, wherever they are. And VDI is the best, most efficient way to do that.
A bunch of folks in the chat are there's a common theme that they're talking
about. It's like an IOPS competition.
Yeah, and well, an IOPS per dollar, per euro, whatever you want to call it. So all of this stuff, does everything we're talking about specifically around the technology for storage, does the fact that IOPS get cheaper and cheaper and faster negate the fact that we need any of this? Or is it truly, as you're kind of saying, we're going this way anyway, and in a year or two, we won't be thinking about do we do storage sort of the old way or the new way? There's only just the way it is. And the concept that we have, you know, disk blocks duplicated anywhere ever would just seem like a sort of, you know, archaic, quaint thing from yesteryear. Like, my question is, does the cost of the driving down the price of IOPS and everything just mean that all of this we're talking about, all these companies reshaping the way storage works, in 2 years is cheap enough that we don't even care? I don't have to mess with it. I'm going to be able to buy 500,000 IOPS in my blade, and I won't need any of this.
No, it's IOPS is one very big cost component, right? And the cheaper that IOPS that component gets, the better it is from, you know, an overall standpoint. But it is still just one component. It is not the only component. There is still compute. Compute is already dirt cheap. CPU cycles are essentially free. And there's memory. And memory and storage are sort of blurring in many ways. They're very amorphous at this point. And I think, truly, at some point, there is no distinction between what is memory and what is, you know, persistent storage. But IOPS will, you know, you will get to zero on IOPS. It's already happening. And when you do get to zero, what's interesting is it's not just VDI that happens, but interesting new applications that were not possible before because you were IOPS constrained that would happen before. I'm going to use, you know, one of the favorite theories that I have from George Gilder, who's one of my favorite writers. And Gilder said every new innovation takes advantage of some surplus, right, to take something that was in a very limited form, was available in a limited form, and make that a surplus. Right, and so if you look at, for example, you know what CPUs did, you know they essentially allowed you to create CPU cycles, and each generation of Moore's law gives you more and more CPU cycles. So you get a surplus of CPU cycles. At some point, you get a technology like a hypervisor that then now efficiently harnesses all those CPU cycles and gives you a much more higher form of value. So we keep going in these incremental waves. And so when the IOPS challenge is fulfilled, when the cost of IOPS goes almost zero, you're going to see new applications evolve that were not possible before. And you know, I can't even.
I was just going to say, can you tell us what those would be? Because I want that. Look, we just signed a 4-year deal with TechTarget.
Right.
Will I see that in the 4 years, or do I have to do another deal after that in 2016?
Well, yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of good research out there. You know, I've been spending a lot of time reading on a lot of fundamental research papers, and you can see that that's happening. There are a lot of smart kids out there. There are a lot of people who are veterans of the software industry who have done their exits, and they're sort of going back and questioning what's the next thing. And one of the thinking points is that the cost of IOPS goes to zero. What next? So, you know, it's definitely coming out there.
Isn't there still a desire then for the optimization piece? I mean, it sounds like the same argument that we use for the network and the WAN, you know, where okay, so I'm being constrained somewhere. I can optimize it, or I can throw more bandwidth at it. The other. And in this case, we're talking about throwing more IOPS at where my constraints are. But also, I mean, I'm saying this kind of keeping in mind Dan Brinkman's thing in the chat room. What?
I'm saying you're breaking up. So I think I told everyone last week, by the way, that we do have a 100 meg connection coming in here to the office. But that has, I think that's this week, maybe?
Yeah.
So let's take a quick break, and hopefully Gabe will be your connection will magically fix itself in the next 30 seconds. But I just want to take another commercial break.
You need to optimize your network, man. I'm going to
call in. All right, so Gabe, you call in. And while Gabe is calling in, I'll say that this episode of Brian and Gabe Live is sponsored by Citrix GoToManage. And I'm going to paraphrase what I said last time during our last commercial break, which is, look, they believe, and I can tell you personally, I believe this too, that when you go to desktop virtualization, regardless whether it's VDI, you know, client VMs, whatever, it's not a free pass to desktop management. You still have to manage this environment. So you need some kind of desktop management for doing remote access, software updates, you know, fixing things, inventory, software, hardware, all that kind of stuff. So Citrix Online has GoToManage, which is essentially their cloud-based desktop management platform. And it has what you'd expect it to have, remote control and inventory and all that kind of stuff, as I said. And they've got, so it's a cloud-based service. You know, everything, their dashboard, all stuff is all powered by them. They've got a free demo you can try. And if you can get the demo from gotomanage.com. If you enter the code Madden45, then that will give you the 45-day trial for unlimited computers in your organization. I believe it's unlimited. We hadn't hit the limit ourselves yet. So anyway, that's device management, tech support, monitoring. They've got an iPad app. That's from Citrix Online at gotomanage.com. So again, thank you, Citrix, for that. I'm not sure if Gabe has connected back in yet. Are you here, Gabe?
Yeah, I'm back. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're telephony. That's awesome. So anyway, say again. Yeah. I want to wrap this conversation up in a couple minutes so we can get on to some of the other things of the week. But share the thoughts the question you were just asking Chetan before the break.
I'm not sure where I dropped off, but my original or where I started was kind of in response to Dan Brinkman's message in the chat room about, you know, he feels like the Atlanta stuff is really awesome, but he just can't shake the feeling that increasing the number of IOPS or the increasing number of cheaper IOPS as time goes by means that the Ilio product is and products like that are going to have a limited lifetime. And my thought there and my question to Chetan really is, I feel like this is kind of like the same kind of conversation we have with LAN bandwidth, you know, where you've got two choices when you have a constraint. You can either throw more bandwidth at it or you can optimize it. And so obviously bandwidth is cheaper, so that's no problem. We can do that. But at some point in time, you can still there's still a lot of benefit to optimizing it. The same thing we're seeing with storage. The IOPS are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and we can provide more of them in smaller packages and so on. But at the same time, it's still not optimized unless we throw something like Ilio in there. So, I mean, is that your train of thought? I mean, or do you feel like maybe – I guess
– Yeah, so, you know –
Do you think that Ilio has a limited lifespan?
I think it's a great question. And it's – I'll answer it this way. I think the storage optimization and the IOPS was Act 1 for Atlantis. And Act 2 is to unleash, you know, better management, the ability to, you know, do all sorts of interesting flow control, you know, service management, all of that stuff at the IOPS level, and fundamentally allow you to, you know, get the cost of an IOP down to zero and then move up the stack to allow you to do better things with those IOPS. So I can't disclose more than that at this point, but... You know, that's one thing. And in VDI, you know, IOPS is a big deal, but there are also lots of server workloads that have an IOPS challenge, and their IOPS problems are different from the VDI IOPS challenge. And storage vendors will shake their head and say, no, they're not, but it is. You know, there are different workloads, and there is no one-size-fits-all. And the beauty of software and something like Ilio is that it's algorithmic, and therefore you can change the algorithm to fit the workload. And so a lot of what we're doing now is going after server use cases as well. For example, we're going to have Ilio for ZenApp product out that's actually in beta right now with a couple of customers.
Oh, wow, because provisioning server is really, really creaky right now. Like, it's getting up in age and hasn't seen too much development, it doesn't look like. So this can sort of reinvigorate what provisioning server did for ZenApp literally 5 years ago.
Right.
We now go from that.
Absolutely. And everybody wants to virtualize ZenApp, or a lot of people do. And they're looking for – and the interesting thing is when you start doing that, it starts to behave, you know, in some ways like VDI. And so there is an overlap, and it becomes an applicable technology. So we're doing that. We're also doing some other server use cases that are a little earlier on, so I won't, you know, comment on those because we might change our mind. You know, but it's certainly an area that we're going after, and it is a challenge. Commoditization is just a known factor. You know, the hypervisor vendors commoditized it, went to zero, and they've moved out into other things, and they're trying to extract value and money from those things. We're going to do the same exact thing.
Okay, so yeah, you just exactly answered the guy's question. How do you make money when this becomes zero? So you just figure, you know, that...
You don't. You do something else. Yeah,
it's cannibalization. It's, you know, it's all of the... It's a good problem to have, let me put it that way.
So in our last 12 minutes here, let's kind of shift gears and get away from talking about VDI and IOPS and user-installed apps and that kind of stuff. Gabe, talk about the series of articles that you just started on consumerized IT. It's our new FU IT series.
So this is – when we started the talk about having a consumerization website, it was what, maybe May, somewhere in there. And the whole time we're like, man, we've got to go get FUIT.com because this whole consumerization thing is about saying fuck you to IT. And like, so we have to go get this, and then we got to have – maybe we make it – maybe we have two sites. Maybe we have one site that's like articles and blog posts and stuff, and we have FUIT.com that's all about, you know, screwing the man, how to actually say FU to IT and that kind of thing. And eventually, we never really did get the go-ahead to do that. And so what we decided to do is when we launched a consumerization website, we would just have a little kind of corner of it for the FUIT topic. And so that's what we did. We started this. It's just a tag in our system. We can go to a tag landing page and see everything that has this FUIT topic. And in there, we're going to keep a list of all the different ways that people are circumventing IT policy. And so the very first post in there is an introduction, like I just said, and then the second post is about how people can use email or can get around their company's corporate email restrictions and policies. Wow. People who we know, but may or may not be us. So, and in those situations, the article that's up there specifically deals with a low, a very small mailbox size, a low attachment size, and a very short retention period, and how all you have to do to circumvent that is to just set up a rule to direct all your email off to a Gmail account where you have 8 gigs of storage and a 25 meg attachment limit, and it will retain that for as long as you want. We've done it in kind of a snarky way with a fake company, and we've made an enemy called the Powers. And so the Powers will be our common enemy throughout all of these FUIT posts that we do ongoing. I'm shooting for one a week.
And yeah, it's funny. Where, oh, where did we get the ideas for, you know, having to get around an IT system? This is a whole thing on consumerization anyway, because a lot of people, as I started talking about consumerization and saying that, you know, users can kind of do whatever they want, you know, the audience that I talk to mostly is IT pros and, you know, desktop admins and people like this. And there's always some percentage in the audience who's like, no, not happening, we're in control. And I'm just thinking, man, if you think it's not happening, you know, that's, you just don't know. Like, I promise you. So it's not even, and then we find also that the people, you know, like in our case, so this is where this whole FUIT thing comes from, because they say, well, you know, like at our company, we have, you know, a SSL VPN, but you have to have the right antivirus and all this kind of stuff just to get your file shares and your file share. And then, you know, so what's our solution? So we just use Dropbox. Right. And, you know, you use, they block Dropbox, so you just type a proxy in Dropbox that we run from home. I mean, you know, it's...
And we've talked about it before, too, where, you know, when you joined TechTarget and went to the San Francisco office, nobody even knew what HTTP over RPC or whatever the Outlook, using Outlook, pure Outlook without connecting to the VPN. And nobody knew what that was, but we had used it at the old company. And so we figured out how to set our Outlook up to connect via that. And then all of a sudden, everybody, now nobody uses the VPN to connect to their email. Right. And so all it takes is one person to do this, and then everybody does it. Once somebody discovers that there's all you have to do is drive around the security gate, then everybody's just going to drive around the security
That's
gate.
That picture of Jim. That's actually your colleague. Right. Jim posted a picture of a little gate across the road, but it was in the snow. So you can see all the tracks, the tire tracks in the snow driving around the gate. Because it was literally just a gate and a road, but the field next to the road had no fence.
It's similar to the one that we use in presentations. I think we're going to have to switch it, though, because James is way better.
Yeah.
You know, this is where I get excited about a product like Horizon, because I think in many ways what it's going to do is give the suits a friendly face and at least satisfy some of the user population that today is saying FUIT. If you can put an app store inside every corporation, inside every enterprise, and allow a syndication process for apps to be brought in by the IT organization. And I think IT organizations fundamentally just, you know, it's the typical set of human reactions. The first human reaction always is anger. The second one is denial. The third one is depression. Fourth one is acceptance. The fifth one is let's do something about it, right? Every organization, every IT organization does exactly the same thing. And so when you're blindsided, and the first thing is to do is to get angry about it and force it in a heavy-handed way, then to get depressed about it, then to deny it, et cetera. They do the same exact things. But ultimately, the constructive way to solve that is to get behind the users. Otherwise, you're just going to fail at that job. And so I think Horizon and that whole set of tools, Citrix Dazzle, for example, I don't know what happened to that.
It's now built in. What the functionality of what Dazzle was is built into the Citrix Receiver platform. So it's just called Receiver now.
It's fantastic because that is going to allow that syndication process and that provisioning process to get behind enabling users. So if you want Dropbox, you want some service out on the cloud, you're going to get it, but you're going to get it in a way that makes everyone comfortable. So I don't necessarily.
I don't think that people are out there trying to maliciously get around IT policies or business policies or whatever those restrictions are that are in place. I don't think people are, there's not that many people at least that are actively trying to circumvent them. It's just that when they're presented with a problem, they just do what it takes to get their job done.
Yeah,
I think you're right. I think if IT embraces it, I think that will go a long way for making everybody happy.
Yeah.
And I think that's it exactly. It's even if there's a lot of people trying to circumvent what IT puts in place, is not because they want to be, they want to do it for the sake of doing it. It's just like if they were given the opportunity to have something else, then off they would go. And so with this site, or with this FUIT column specifically, we had the initial idea of like it'd be fun to make like how-to guides, like how to configure Outlook RPC over HTTP, how to use Dropbox instead of corporate VPN, how to set up a proxy to use AIM at work.
You're like the Pirate Bay of enterprise.
Yeah, but
IT.
Then we realized if we did that, man, we're going to get every single like 15-year-old and like 60-year-old, who finds that via Google, and then it's emailing us and like, oh, I don't see it because in Outlook Service Pack 2, they moved the checkbox over here. So we decided to flip it around and write it more, which is, honestly more work appropriate for us anyway, to make it more for IT pros to read, which is like, oh, by the way, here's how your users are doing this kind of stuff. And I always tell the story at these events when I was visiting a fairly large, like 100,000 plus person company, and I was talking with the CIO, and she was talking about how, they have all this like great policy where they block attachments from non-secure devices. So it's like, that's how they get around security. And then I walk out of that room with my PR person, and the first thing she does, the PR person working at this company, and the first thing she does when we're outside the room is pick up her iPhone and say, yeah, no, send me the presentation. No, I'm on my iPhone. Send it to my Gmail. Right. And I want to tell the CIO, like, I don't want to screw the CIO, but I want to say, so you know that... and what are you going to do, block Gmail? I mean, come on. So they're going to, like, the sender has Gmail too, and if you block Gmail, then they're going to send it from their MiFi, their 3G connection, So it's just one of those things. But so, Chetan, I don't know if you have, you've built yourself a nice little real company. How do you get around your internal IT stuff? Or do you get, like, ultimate control since you're CTO?
So, it's funny. It's a different life, part of the life cycle, and I see my company in some ways becoming that type of a company that you make fun of. So we've standardized on a laptop model, and if you don't want that laptop model, you buy your own. But we support that, thank God. We've been cloud friendly from day one, so almost everything that we have is out on the cloud, and it's not gotten as crazy and heavy-handed, but I certainly see people just using whatever tool makes sense for the job. If Dropbox makes sense, people screamed about the Dropbox agreement, and saying, I think they own all the content or there's something like that.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, palpitations about that. So we made, certain accommodations. We don't put some of our intellectual property stuff on Dropbox, for example. If you're writing up a patent or something like that, you don't put that there. Put that somewhere else. So.
You hope they don't put that there. You ask them nicely not to put that there, but...
Yeah, you can.
I bet your patents are in Dropbox right now.
You're just basically ultimately relying on the good sense of people to do what's right, and you hopefully can educate them. We don't have a full-time IT guy yet. We don't need to because in many ways
you're a good-sized company for no full-time IT person.
We've got a part-time guy, and it's because that we've sort of said use the right tool for the job, and try and educate people about what the dangers are. That's about the extent I think you can do. It's like parenting, man. I mean, ultimately, if your kid's going to go and smoke weed, he's going to go and smoke weed. I mean, all that you can do is educate them and give them the best of everything and hope that they make the right decision. So
what do you mean, give them the best pot?
Well, you could tell.
Good parents don't let their kids smoke ditch weed.
I don't know. It's basically that. You have to give up that illusion of control.
Well, I tell a story. We had family in our neighborhood growing up where the parents allowed their high school age kids to drink in their own basement, and they took away the keys, and they kind of said the same thing, like, hey, they're gonna drink anyway, so I'd rather have them drinking and puking in my own basement instead of driving around running away from people, which was a very controversial thing, but all those kids who were down there are still alive today.
Right.
And I hate to be so crass on that, but, you know, that was it. So in our last minute or so, Chet, I want to ask you, I want to revisit something we talked about earlier. There's a couple folks in the chat. Mm-hmm. Who just asked if you can quantify the 50-50 between Zen Desktop and VMware Vue. And so I think
they want us to quantify that.
Well, yeah, so well,
but, independent.
Yeah, I mean, well, but is it, I mean, so what you're seeing, 50-50 Vue versus Zen Desktop, is this what your proofs of concept, new deployments? I mean, because I think people are surprised that Vue has such a large market share from what you're saying, from again just what you're seeing personally.
So most of our production deployments are driven by Zen Desktop simply because of, you know, the presence it had before. A lot of the POCs now are Vue based, so 50-50 is more reflective of some of the new initiatives, some of the new POCs, etc. What we tend to see with larger deployments are they're Zen Desktop based because of that farm architecture, etc. Allows you to, you know, do whatever, and I think Vue will sort of catch up and get there you know, as you start to see these rollouts. But 50-50 really is a POC perspective, not production deployments. A lot of production is still on Zen Desktop. Yeah.
All right. So that's actually the end of our hour. It actually went by pretty fast. So we have there's a lot more to talk about. But luckily, next Tuesday is only 7 days away. So next week we'll be back same time. We have we'll kind of pick up this conversation where we left off. I know in the chat people are talking about user installed apps. I think we should probably bring on a guest like Ruben Sprout in the future and talk about that. We should probably bring on Claudio and talk about BYOC. Ron Oglesby, if you're still out there, we should bring on you and maybe talk about UIA some more. And I think, you know, for all of you who are listening today, thank you so much for taking the time to Citrix Online and their GoToManage, which you can download trial for 45 days with the Madden 45 code. Thank you to Citrix for sponsoring. Chetan, thank you so much for making the super early drive up here.
Hey, no problem. It's a pleasure, Brian and Gabe and Jack. Thanks so much for having me here.
Gabe, thank you for dialing in. Jack?
Yeah, hopefully next week we'll have it fixed.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have a faster connection next week. Jack, thanks for coming in too, although you didn't have to come in as far.
Of course.
And again, thanks for listening. So from San Francisco, this is Brian Madden. We'll see you next week.